Good morning, everyone. How many of you have read the chapter? So there was the short version of the soapbox lecture that I gave you during the first day where I said that I can tell you what it is that you need to do to get through this course, and then it is up to you all to do it. So especially since we had a real lecture on Monday and not just an introduction to the syllabus, and since we really are diving into the chapter today, don't make the mistake of getting behind right at the beginning of the quarter when you're fresh. Don't put yourself through the torment of having to cram for chemistry when you've also got physics, biology, and math that are coming screaming at you as well. So make sure you read that chapter soon, because when is your first quiz? Monday, isn't it? Less than a week away. And if you haven't started reading, that means that's that many fewer days that you have for that material to kind of rattle around in your head and maybe finally settle in. So do get around to reading that soon. Section 1, I already asked you this. So section 2, how many of you have already downloaded the syllabus and taken a look at it? Okay, which that's okay in a sense because there's nothing that you're going to be quizzed on, except that is the document that has all of the course policies. So if you're in a course that you're taking from me, you might want to know what my policies are, which I know I described them ad nauseum during that first day in lab, but you should go ahead and look over it your own self. We are going to be talking about solutions today, but we, in section 2, are also going to be talking about solutions in lab. So some of the things you might expect me to talk about in lecture, I'm not going to, only because you're going to hear them later on in lab. So specifically in lab, we're going to talk about freezing point depression, which is a colligative property. We will talk in lab about what causes freezing point depression. We'll also do a review of some terminology related to solutions, like definitions for solution, solute, solvent, all of those sol words. In here, I want to focus on units of measure of concentration, and I also want to talk about the energetics and forming of solution. There is a little bit of review that we're going to have to do in order to do that, and although it might not initially seem connected, where we'll start our review is what the difference is between a covalent and an ionic bond. So what is the difference between a covalent bond and an ionic bond? Okay, covalent means to have co-control. Valency means having power over something. For example, if we refer to carbon being tetravalent, that means that carbon likes to have four bonds to it. So covalent means a sharing of electrons. So a covalent bond is a bond in which electrons are shared between atoms. An ionic bond is, in contrast, a bond in which electrons are transferred from one atom to another. Normally that ends up producing ions, and then those ions are attracted together by electrostatics. In other words, negative and positive attract. So it's not the electron itself, in that case, that is keeping the atoms together. It is just charge. So an ionic bond is a bond in which electrons are transferred between atoms, forming ions that are then attracted together. What do we do about something like the bond between hydrogen and oxygen in water? Because what is it that determines whether a bond is covalent or ionic? It is something that we've already talked about this quarter. Electronegativity. So remember the definition of electronegativity. It is the tendency of an atom in order to be able to draw electron density towards itself. It's the tug of war that goes on between two atoms in a bond. Well, if there is only a small difference in the electronegativity between the two atoms, or let's say that we have two identical atoms bonded to each other, well, then you'll have very equal pull on that electron density between the atoms, and so the electrons are going to end up being shared. So if you have a molecule like H2, diatomic hydrogen, because you have equal electronegativity, equal sharing, very covalent bond. But if you have something like sodium chloride, sodium on the left-hand side of the periodic table is something that likes to ionize to form positive charges, low ionization energy. On the right-hand side of the table, you have something like chlorine, which is much more electronegative, which is related to the fact it likes to gain electrons. So put the two elements together, sodium becomes positively charged, chlorine becomes negatively charged, then those two attract together in the form of an ionic bond. So it is the difference in electronegativity that determines what kind of bond that you have. The type of bond present between two atoms can be determined by the difference in electronegativity of the two atoms. Now, there's not a good firm cutoff point necessarily, and this reflects the fact that we usually use both models of bonding to more fully describe what happens in molecules. Even in something like sodium chloride, where we think of that as a very classic case of ions being brought together as an ionic compound, there is still some aspects of the behavior of sodium chloride that are better modeled by a covalent bonding model. And that's because atoms aren't just points, electrons are somewhat spread out. And so there's some covalent nature to even sodium chloride. Something like water. Water has very polar bonds, which means there is an uneven distribution. So even if we call the bonds in water covalent, we usually qualify that and say that they're polar covalent, which means that to some small extent, an ionic model would be appropriate for describing water. Now, those details we're not so much worried about right at the moment. We more care about ionic compounds versus covalent compounds because we want to know what happens to those when they try to dissolve. But in order to understand the difference between covalent and ionic compounds, we have to know the difference between covalent and ionic bonding. So does anyone have any questions on these two types of bonds? Then what is it that would cause a covalent molecule to come together to be a solid? Yes. That's exactly right. The intermolecular forces, because covalent molecules might have charges, but more generally, they're going to be neutral compounds, the compounds that we deal with in this course, at least. So if you have something that doesn't have a true formal charge, then what is it that can bring compounds together? Well, interactions between dipoles. And in a bit, we'll more discuss the types of attractions that there are. To briefly run through them, just to, as a warm-up, you could have something like water, where because of its polarity due to its asymmetry, it's got a plus end and a minus end, and two molecules of water can therefore attract each other. You can end up in a situation where you have something like a fat molecule. A fat molecule is going to be a long molecule that's usually very nonpolar. But because it's got a large surface area, what can happen is that as that molecule is wiggling around in space, just temporarily, there might be an imbalance in charge that develops. Well, while that imbalance is there, that can cause it to be able to be attracted to another molecule. And so even if you have molecules that are nonpolar, you have what are known as dispersion forces that can still bring them together. Now, if you did have something that's part covalent, part ionic, like a soap, many soaps are exactly that combination, something that I think might be mentioned in section 2 of the chapter, then you could have ion-dipole interactions, which are pretty strong. So there's many ways in which the molecules that are covalent can be drawn together, and all that can be summed up by this phrase, intermolecular forces. So covalent compounds form solids due to their intermolecular forces. So EN, electronegative or electronegativity, that's something I'm going to use all throughout the quarter. So just get used to that abbreviation, just like IMF. We're going to be talking about intermolecular forces a bunch, so I'm not going to keep on redefining it each time I use the abbreviation. Now, this is important because there is no bond breaking involved then in splitting a covalent compound apart. Whether a compound dissociates, in other words, experiences bond breaking, is an entirely different thing than whether it dissolves, at least in the case of covalent compounds. I want to put that in red because it is wrong to use the word bond in this situation. So covalent compounds do not necessarily experience dissociation, bond breaking, when they dissolve. Instead, it is just the fact that you've got enough kinetic energy to overcome those intermolecular forces. This is an entirely different situation for ionic compounds, because what is it that causes ionic compounds to form solids? Now, I don't always care if you have the right answer, because if you all knew everything, you wouldn't be in this room. So even a good guess is good enough for me. What causes ionic compounds to come together as solids? Charges, that's right. That's what makes them have ionic bonds, the fact that they're attracted to each other by charge. What makes ionic compounds a little more complicated then is that they don't have necessarily nice discrete bonds, because you can have an array of atoms in all different directions where many atoms are interacting with each other in terms of charge. In fact, it's the atoms trying to come together to pack as well as they can to maximize that interaction between charges that causes them to form different structures. I think some of you might have reviewed very briefly different types of crystal structures in 1B. The square, cubic, or face-centered, or any of that, those terms. Okay, so that's just describing how these things come together. But there, again, ionic compounds form solids due to the attraction of ions. This will explain why we have to calculate energy changes when we form a solution in two different ways. Because the way that a covalent compound disperses itself in solution is different than the way an ionic compound disperses itself. So we have two ways of calculating energy changes. Which, before we get to that, I do want to switch topics slightly and talk about units of concentration, just because this is the best time to do it. Before we move on, though, does anyone have any questions about what we've covered so far? Okay. So what is concentration? It is the amount of solute versus the amount of solvent that is present. Section 1 might have stayed silent because they got the runaround this morning because I was insisting that they define things like solute and solvent and solution without using any words with sol in it. And it turned out to be kind of an interesting exercise. But for right now, it's fine for us to use those words. So yes, concentration is a measure of the quantity of solute versus the quantity of solvent or solution. And I say both because depending on what unit of measure we're using, it might be solvent that we focus on, it might be solution that we focus on. In fact, let's just get to the two most common units that you're going to have to use. What unit of concentration have you seen ever since Chem 1A? Molarity, that's correct. M-O-L-A-R-I-T-Y, with a capital M as the unit. I put little feet on my capitals just to make sure that you know that it's capital and not a lowercase m. What is the definition of molarity? Moles per liter. Moles what per liter what? Moles solute per liter. Yeah, that I heard two answers right then, and I heard some people correcting the other people. So which is it? Moles solute per liter solvent or liter solution? Are you sure? You're right. There's a difference between the volume of solution and the volume of solvent because there's going to be some change in that volume once you put the solute in it. Why is it that we define the unit the way we do? Because it makes it very convenient to measure out a certain number of moles by measuring out a certain amount of volume. Because moles, usually represented by lowercase n, can be calculated by taking molarity and using the volume of the solution that you have, not worrying about how much of that volume is solvent versus solute, because that's not how we measure things out. We just pour. So this is a very convenient measure for measuring out solutions. It also happens to work out well in many equations. For example, the very popularly named Beer's Law that you might have used back in Chem 1A, that has a linear relationship between concentration in terms of molarity versus absorbance. But there are other equations in which molarity is not the best unit to use, most specifically the equations for colligative properties, the things that we're learning about in this chapter. So instead of molarity, we have an alternate unit of molality, lowercase m. And how is molality defined? That's correct. It is moles solute over kilograms solvent, not solution. We will later on do some practice problems converting between these units. There are other units we're going to be worrying about in terms of solution, parts per million, percent mass, percent volume, and thinking about what's coming later in the quarter, we also need to worry about maximum solubility, which is often given in grams per milliliter, yet another unit of concentration. So just for now, the definitions are good enough. Anyone have any questions about these definitions? Now we're going to get to energetics, what happens when things dissolve. But before I do that, we have to do a very brief review of thermodynamics. And I do mean brief. We just need to have some very essential terminology. One very fundamental definition is what a system is. And what is a system? It's kind of like asking what heat is. Everybody knows what it is, but when you ask for a definition, everybody pauses, thinks, well, it's hot. Heat is hot. What is a system? Yes. It's this thing that you're trying to describe, which, yes, it's this. It is an arbitrary frame of reference. It is whatever you want it to be. Usually the system of chemicals, I use the word system to define system, the set of chemicals reacting. But, you know, if you were being really careful, you have to decide, well, do you want just the reactants, or do you also mean the solvent that contains the reactants, or do you also mean the container that has that solution, or do you also mean the surrounding atmosphere that is absorbing heat or releasing heat to that beaker that holds the solution? You know, you can define the system however you want to, which that's the point. A system is an arbitrary frame of reference. The reason I want to talk about a system is because we're going to talk about energy changes, energy coming into the system or coming out of the system. And we have these different units of energy that we could worry about. There's internal energy, which is often represented by U, which is essentially the same as our definition of heat that I gave us on Monday, which is the total amount of energy due to the atoms or molecules wiggling around in space. So the vibrational, translation, rotational motion of the atoms in that system, which can't be measured directly. It also is not the most useful unit of measure of energy for chemistry. There's one that's much more useful, which is enthalpy, often expressed by delta H. The reason it is delta H, because like internal energy, it cannot be directly measured, but we can measure changes in enthalpy. There's a reason why we use enthalpy instead of internal energy, and that's because there's an adjusted made for what is called pressure volume work. And I'm not going to be asking questions about this quarter. That is something you should have had in 1A and 1B. But I just want to point out there is a reason why we use enthalpy. And that's because most chemical reactions occur under constant pressure. You know, they occur in an open environment in the lab often, but at least during the time scale of many experiments, the pressure in a lab room doesn't change much. And so what little bitty volume change you might experience in solutions does count as a little bit of work, but in many cases that change is so tiny that it almost can just be ignored. And so in many cases, enthalpy is the exact same thing as internal energy or heat. But to give you just a brief definition that we can work with, enthalpy is heat adjusted for pressure volume work, and it's used in systems at constant pressure. Pointing out that there is a technical definition, we'll now ignore it, and we'll just consider it as heat, because as I mentioned, even if we make the correction, it's usually tiny, and so it's almost always the same thing as heat. So there's a sign convention, meaning that if the change in energy is less than zero, that means that it's going some direction, into or out of the system. Which way is heat going if delta H is less than zero? Out, because what that means is the system is losing energy. That's what the sign convention is. You know, if there's something moving in or out, you have to figure out, well, are you going to talk about it from the perspective of the system, or are you going to talk about the perspective of outside the system? And our definition of sign is always for the system itself. So if you have a negative number, that means the heat went out. And so what is the word that we usually use for this then? Exothermic. Which means heat is lost from the system. If we have delta H greater than zero, endothermic, which would mean heat absorbed by the system. Great. Now, a couple of more review definitions. Part of the reason we're taking the time to do this now is we do need to talk about entropy later on, and we also have to talk about free energy. And in order to do that successfully, we need to make sure that we got the fundamentals. So here's another fundamental. There are what are known as state functions and path functions. Can someone tell me what a state function is? And I guess after that, we'll have to talk about what a state is. What about a path function? No takers? Here's the picture I usually give to explain the difference between the two. Let's say that this is us here at De Anza, and let's say that the only way that you stay awake in your chemistry class is by running over to Coffee Society across the street and loading up before coming over here. If I asked you what is the shortest distance between those two points, then what is that distance? How do we measure it? We draw a line, right? The proverbial distance between two points is a straight line. Is that distance ever going to change? Not unless we have an earthquake and the ground moves, no. The point is that it doesn't matter how we as humans might walk or drive or bike between here and there. If all I'm asking is the displacement, the difference between those two points, there's only one way that you do it. You look at the starting point and you look at the ending point. Instead of using the word point, I'll use the word state, because this is exactly what a state function is. A state function is a function in which the value depends only on its initial and final states and not at all how you change between those two states. What would be a graphical representation of a path function then? The way that we really would get there, because most of us can't walk through walls, so we have to take a non-linear path to get there. And of course, our unique path might be different for each one of us. So if I ask how far does it take you to get there, well, each one of you might give me a different answer. And so that means the value of that function, distance traveled, entirely depends on how that occurred, which means it is a path function. So, a state function is a function the value of which only depends on the initial and final states and not at all on how the system changes. A path function, in contrast, is a function the value of which entirely depends on how a system changes, and not on the initial or final states. Work is a path function, because depending how that object or electron moves around, it's going to involve more energy. What is Hess's law? thought I heard you say something. No. Yes. Which means that energy in a chemical reaction is what? A state function. That is the point of Hess's law. Yes. Yes. Work is a path function. That means that if I have an object, let's say I have a ball that I'm going to, or a brick that I'm going to push around on the table here, I might want it to start out at this corner and end up on that corner. If I push it in a straight line like that, that's a certain amount of energy that I'm going to have to expend. But if I push it all around the table, that's a different amount of energy. So the work done depends on the path that I took. So work is a path function. That's the same thing like for those of you in calculus, path integrals. You know, the value depends on exactly the function that you're following. Same type of thing here. What I just said about Hess's law is super duper important. Energy changes in chemical reactions are state functions. Another way explaining or describing Hess's law is that if you have multiple chemical processes that add together to give you the same overall process as some other reaction, that the overall energy change can be determined just by adding up all the individual energy changes. That's the usefulness of Hess's law, but it's based on the fact that energy changes in chemical reactions are state functions. Meaning they only depend on the identities of the reactants and products. Not on how the reaction occurs. I used another abbreviation just then, RxN. Chemists use it all the time to mean reaction. So I'll give us one definition then of Hess's law. Which is that it states that if a chemical reaction can occur by two different pathways, the energy change for both pathways will be the same. That's why, for example, putting a catalyst into a reaction does not change the equilibrium constant for that reaction. It just changes how quickly that reaction is going to occur. Because the energy change only depends on the products and reactants, and that energy change is related to equilibrium. Now, I'll show you why we need to go back to this definition of Hess's law in just a second. But before we move on to that, are there any more questions for what we've covered up to this point? Okay. The reason we need Hess's law is because we're going to be talking about the energy changes in solution. And we can identify multiple sources that cause energy changes. But what we want to look at is this overall heat of solution. How much energy is released or absorbed when something dissolves? Well, what Hess's law is going to tell us then is we can add together each of those contributing factors, and by Hess's law, we should get the same value as the overall heat of solution. Because all that matters is we're taking two substances and making a solution out of them, and however we want to describe that process, whether in one step or in several, the overall energy change is going to be the same. So let's start with forming solutions. From covalent compounds. And the example that I'm going to use for my set of compounds is water and ethanol. Ethanol, the eth part of the name, means a two-carbon compound. The carbon compounds do have a regular naming system. Once they get large enough, we start using prefixes like you've heard in the past, pentane, hexane, heptane, octane. But smaller than that, we use some other historical terms. So meth, same as in the street meth, means one carbon. Eth means two carbons. Prop means two or three. And bute means four. So butane, as in lighters, means a four-carbon compound. Ethanol is the active ingredient in alcoholic beverages. It is a type of alcohol. Alcohol is not just one substance. It's any carbon compound that has this OH group in it. Water and ethanol are what are known as a miscible system, because it doesn't matter how much water or how much ethanol you have, they'll always dissolve in each other. What happens when these two things dissolve? For the few of you who raised your hands and said that you had read the textbook, can you recall how we describe these two things forming a solution? What are the three things that happen? Yes. That's right. You have to pull the solute molecules apart from each other. You have to pull the solvent molecules apart from each other. And then the solute and the solvent mix together. So let's get those three energy changes. Is that energy change going to be greater than or less than or equal to zero? Greater than zero. Why? Because it takes energy to pull the molecules apart, because you have to overcome those intermolecular forces. The same is going to be true of the solvent. Now, what happens when you put the molecules back together again, though? They're going to be attracted to each other again, which, if you have attractions, they're moving closer to each other. They're doing so because they're releasing energy. So I'll call it the heat of mixing, and that heat is going to be a negative value, less than zero, because the molecules are coming back together again. So to graphically apply Hess's law, what we could do is we could start out where we have the solute and solvent. Then one step is where we add energy to pull the solute molecules apart. And that would be delta H solute, the energy change that's involved, the way that I've labeled it here, at least. We then have another energy change that can occur, And that's where we pull the solvent molecules apart. So that would be delta H solvent. And then we have the third step of all those molecules interacting with each other. And at the end of that third step, we will then have the solution. So we did this process in three steps, but Hess's law says you could calculate the energy change of what it would be if you just did everything in one step. Say we did a calorimetry experiment to measure the heat change, and we didn't know what the three individual values were. Well, we could come up with that experimentally, but it should match the sum of these three values. And so all that together is the heat of solution. So the heat of solution is equal to the heat of the solute being pulled apart, plus the heat of the solvent being pulled apart, plus the heat released by those things mixing again. That's our picture for covalent systems. What about ionic systems? Let's see how that's different. But before we do, let me pause. Questions about the graph or anything we discussed related to this graph? You already know the answer to the question, is this going to be on a quiz or an exam? Because if I said it in lecture, it's on a quiz or an exam. So you're very likely to have to at least describe this kind of process and very likely have to draw some kind of graph just like this. That is your instructor giving you a big fat hit what he's thinking about putting on the quiz for Monday. Right? Don't say I never did anything for you all. Telling you what's on the quiz. By the end of the quarter, I get so desperate just for you all to learn something, I just pretty much tell you, well, this is going to be this question. What gets me, though, is then people don't still study, even if they know the questions. But then I can't do anything, right? Forming ionic solutions, or solutions from ionic compounds. An example here would be sodium chloride, table salt, and water. And I am describing a more specific case of an ionic solid going into water. So what are the energy changes involved now? Well, that goes back to what causes ionic compounds to be solids. I should emphasize, the reason that we had the changes we described here for covalent compounds is because of how covalent compounds are held together. You have the solute that becomes a solid because of intermolecular forces. So there's one energy change to get over those. The solvent, even if it's a liquid, if you're trying to pull those molecules apart, well, that's intermolecular forces again. And it's intermolecular forces that cause the energy release once you mix everything. But ionic compounds are held together differently. And so what do you have to do to separate an ionic compound? Separate the ions, right? So if you take a solid ionic compound and you blast it apart into its ions, that'll be a set of ions that are in the gaseous state. What energy change is that called when we go from an ionic compound to just its set of ions? It is dissociation, but for ionic compounds, it gives it a special name, lattice energy. What is a lattice? It is a regular repeating geometric pattern The easiest pattern to describe would be something like in sodium chloride. Sodium, chlorine, sodium, chlorine, alternating in all directions of a cube. So if you pull all those ions apart, you have a bag full of ions that are in the gas phase. By definition, that energy change is the lattice energy, the energy released when all those atoms come together into their normal geometric arrangement, which that arrangement is called a lattice, which is why it's called lattice energy. So there's the separation of ions, which is lattice energy. Which is always going to be greater than zero, because it always takes energy to pull ions apart. The second part, and this is specific for aqueous solutions, which is what we're normally going to be talking about. For aqueous solutions, water surrounds those ions. Well, that's always a favorable process, because the negative ions will be attracted to the positive part of water, in other words, the hydrogens. And positive ions will be attracted to the negative part of oxygen, the negative part of water, which is the oxygen. That process of surrounding the ions is called hydration. And that's always going to be less than zero because, as I just said, water likes to surround ions. So we can draw a similar graph for this process like we did for the covalent process. It's a simpler graph because there's only two things on it. And I'm using sodium chloride because it gives us an interesting result. So here is sodium chloride solid plus H2O liquid. We can pull sodium chloride apart, which now means we have its ions technically in the gas phase. We still have regular water, so that is lattice energy. And then we'll have energy released by the ions becoming surrounded by water. So that is the heat of hydration, which is always a negative value, will end up with sodium chloride as a aqueous solution. And Hess's law says, again, that because we're going to want to go from the overall process of having the solid sodium chloride to it being in the solution, we could just add the two values together because I start and end at the same place. And that is our heat of solution, which is a positive value. Now, normally, or if we were only looking at energy changes, we would say that if you have an exothermic process, that's favorable because things like to roll downhill. To go up in energy, that takes some effort. Well, sodium chloride, we all know from common experience, dissolves very easily in water. But look at this. This says that the energy change when you put salt in water is positive, meaning you absorb energy in order to get the salt to dissolve. So that seems like it shouldn't be favorable. So why is it that salt dissolves? Entropy, which is what we'll have to talk about next lecture because we are totally out of time. So we will continue with solutions. We will do some conversion between units, and we'll talk about the entropy aspect of solutions in lecture on Friday.